Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers, our interviewer, and welcome to Jason Tam, today's guest in Room 42. He's a native to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and an assistant professor of technical communication and rhetoric at Texas Tech University. Jason teaches user experience, information design, and digital rhetoric while doing research in technical communication practices, pedagogy, technology, especially. And he's very interested in design thinking, how it can help bring about meaningful discussion to the modern workplace and in higher education. His most recent book, Design Thinking in Technical Communication, unpacks the relationship between design-centric methods for strategic problem solving, collaboration, teaching and learning, and socially responsive innovation. In addition, he's co-authored a book with Joe Moses of the University of Minnesota called the Collaborative Writing Playbook. It provides a flexible framework for team-based projects using design thinking attributes. Today, Dr. Jason Tam is here to help us start answering the question, how does design thinking impact writing professionals? Good morning, welcome.
So excited you're here. Jason, I am delighted to be talking. I'm so glad that you're here with us.
Yes, I'm delighted
to be talking to you. Now, I will give you, truth. I have your book. I started reading your book and I've been through parts of your book and it's really very good. I really enjoy it. But I haven't finished it all yet. So I was hoping that you could help explain for everybody what is design thinking?
Yeah, for sure. Well, again, thank you for inviting me to this session. So there are many definitions really for design thinking. If you do a Google search, you will probably arrive at several. There are consulting firms that are using the term, and there are also academics who are using the term in their pedagogy. For me, the way I use it is to put it simply, I think design thinking is both a methodology as well as a mindset for problem solving. So in terms of methodology, it provides a way of solving problems with different phases and different tools. Mm-hmm. And as a mindset, it tells the person who's using it what sort of mentality to be in, what values to keep in mind when we are solving problems. So that's how I see design thinking.
Yeah, because there's a lot of misconceptions of what is design thinking. I mean, if you just take the word and you're unfamiliar with it, design, to me, my mind would go to, structure and art and things like that and architecture and things that are physical. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, are there some misconceptions out there about what design thinking is?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. In the opening of my book, I kind of talk about that in which design thinking sometimes is taken up as graphic design or interface design. But I mean, it is not just that. I think it is important to keep in mind that design thinking is about using a set of values and attributes in solving problems. So it's like, I use the metaphor of a lens, right? It's like wearing glasses. So it's, if you put on a different color, shaded lens, you're going to see things differently, right? So right. Into the world. So
right. So design the proverbial rose-colored glasses, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then you're going to see rose-colored world. So that's how I think design thinking is one of those frameworks where you put it on and it guides you into ways, a way of looking into the world and the problems that we are addressing.
So in design thinking, it's more focused on who you're serving when you're creating communication. It's who you're serving, right?
Yes. So that's the primary goal of design thinking, is to be user-centered. And for technical communicators and writing professionals, I don't think that is a new concept, right?
Right. Because it's what they all, that's written into the core of every right. technical and professional writer.
Yeah. Right. Always thinking about our audience. We're thinking about our user, customers, consumers, right? But design thinking kind of amplifies that. I think, in my opinion, I think it because it's built into that process of design where you start with empathy, right? You start with having compassion and having empathy for the user, looking at problems from their standpoint and not from a system design, what we need to come up with, right? It's about addressing what users want. So design thinking start out by defining, you empathize with the user, you define the problems that they are experiencing, and use a user-centered sort of design and problem-solving mentality to address those issues.
Right, and I can't remember where exactly in the book you were framing it, and it kind of painted the picture of you really don't take it from the technology perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You take it from how does the individual, like if it were me, how I would use that technology.
Right.
Versus the features of the technology trying to teach you how to use it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't explain it nearly as good as you did in your book.
Every time I try to come back to definitions, you know, it's I look at it sort of differently too, because of what I'm doing. So design thinking really prompts you to do research and understanding users first, and not come from the designers or even a business kind of purpose. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times, if we are driven by business needs and sales and profit,
right.
that's going to drive us away in most situations, going to drive us away from what the market really needs,
mm-hmm.
right? So understanding the everyday experience of the user, right? If I'm working to design something for an office worker, I really do need to go sit down at a desk for, you know, 8 hours a day and really experience it from that perspective, right? Rather than from the sort of organization or the system approach, right? Telling people what they need to do rather than what they really want in using the different technologies.
Mm-hmm. And it changes the whole perspective too, because it's changing that perspective from, you know, even from the creator, from an engineering perspective,
mm-hmm.
you're not coming at it from, I'm going to do this feature. You're coming at it from, how can I make their lives better?
Right. Yeah. So one exercise I think that I typically have my students do is when I ask them to design, say, like an app, you know, not mm-hmm. like a real app, but just an interface concept design, right? To address some kind of issues that they have in life. A lot of times we see that they jump in straight into, okay, we want to have this function. We want to have this feature, right? Without really starting with why. Why do we want to have, say like photographing or video taking features for your app? Well, because it's cool or because that's what people are doing. but doesn't mean that that's going to be a solution, right, to the problems that you're trying to address through the app. So that's one way I kind of teach students to think about, look, it's important to start with knowing the problems from the user perspective. And therefore, doing research in the beginning, it's going to be crucial for you to arrive at those insights, and you use the insights to guide your design and your ideation process.
Right. So if you're using design thinking in TPC, in technical and professional communication, then you're say you're doing like help, right? You're doing online help.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would take the perspective of how does an end user, or how does the person who needs help, how do they use help? What are they looking for? Why mm-hmm. are they there?
Correct.
Yeah.
And what's driving them?
Is that
like looking at things from a design thinking
mm-hmm. mode? Yeah, definitely. And thankfully we have data and we have analytics that can help us in that process too, right? You want to know what keywords people are searching for,
right.
and what kind of troubleshooting, right? They're looking in a help guide, for example. And that way you kind of know like, okay, so what are some of the core issues and why are those issues there in the first place, right? So then you kind of use a grounded, you know, bottom-up sort of solution rather than saying when you're designing documentation, you know, say we want to have these three categories and we want to have these main questions answered in the FAQs without really asking, are these the main questions that people are asking, right? And are these,
right.
Like, you know, the most important questions or the most frequent questions, right? Sometimes I just look at FAQs and I'm like, the first question is really not the question that I will ask, really. So you know the ones that are well designed, they are the one who really addresses like head on, right? When you go to a help guide or whatever, the first few ones are going to be the most important.
Oh, and don't get me started on FAQs though. Why should someone go to an FAQ? It's like a junk drawer. Right?
Yeah, it's like, here's where you put all the things that did not make it.
Right. The things that, you know, we didn't write in the instructions better. So we'll just put it in this FAQ. not kind of discern why is this a frequently asked question. Maybe if we like fed the information better, they wouldn't need that question, wouldn't be in their hand. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I like that thinking. You know, if it is a well-designed system, you probably don't need...
You don't need an FAQ, there's no question.
Right. It should be intuitive and it should be, you know, user-friendly, right?
To put right.
Those terms, yeah.
Well, right, and to your point, if we're using design thinking, then we're answering their question before they even have it.
Right.
Like it's there for them because we're coming from that human-centered, I like this is a little quote from you, but human-centered problem-solving orientation. I love that, I highlighted it.
Yeah.
In my book. And that, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, those are not my words, but as in like people before me came up with those terms. So I did not coin human centered.
Well, but it's in your book and I highlighted it just so you know.
Yeah, no, but that's something that I rely on as a design philosophy that we think about humans and not just like people as users, but thinking about their emotions, right? Their human needs, right? We need humane technologies and not just functions and features, things that can perform and make our life efficient. We want things that really help us be more human and be more responsive, right? To problems that are around us, not just in the workplace or professional lives, but our day-to-day personal and social lives are also important to be taken care of. So that human-centeredness, I think, puts us into that mentality and thinking not just for profit or enterprising, but really, how can we address social problems? I think one of the most attractive aspects of design thinking is that it really pulls us into social innovation. I think that's...
Yeah, you were talking about that.
Right. Yeah, so innovation.
Sorry, say it. You were talking about that in your book.
Right. Yeah. I was inspired by, so there is this is a growing movement. And I think one of the main proponent of it really is Stanford University's Design Institute. And they really focus on designing for social good. So we're looking at building and training designers that are responsive to the society and to social problems and you know, and I think engineers do that too, right? In civil engineering, architecture, and urban planning and design, those are all related to our personal
life. Yeah, and all of those people are interested. We talked to somebody a few episodes ago. I'm not good at name dropping. I can't remember. Really great conversation, but he was talking about how, you know, a lot of people don't know what TPC people do. Like they don't know. And it's not their fault. They just don't know. So they don't. So he got involved in projects that were like in STEM and in psychology with these people who had no clue until somehow they connected and they connected in various ways. And when people who are technical and professional communicators are involved in science and technology, engineering and mathematics at the very beginning phases, everything comes out better. Mm-hmm. You know, engineers like to design things that are going to be used and appreciated. And if you've got the technical and professional communicators involved, it helps them to bridge that gap and see that humanistic side, right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So one of the things that we advocate for really is for, especially for larger design teams, is to put in, you know, technical professional communication specialists in there. Because they're trained with these sort of humanistic thinking and background that they can add to the scientific and technical processes. So we're not just thinking about the technical problems, but we bring in the social aspect and the human aspect of things. And we focus on that when we do our research and our design. So we're not sort of, you know, cited only on problems that are technical, right? We look at problems from human perspectives.
Right, exactly.
And that happens through the entire project design and implementation and production process, right? Getting that stuff done early and are at all the stages along the way improves the overall result.
Oh yeah, definitely. And thankfully, that's a trajectory that I'm seeing in businesses and in organizations, whether or not they're doing design. Like if they're, I guess, if you're doing services too, those are design services, right? How do you make customers feel better and wanting your service, right? And that requires a similar kind of thinking. Design thinking is as in the empathy and human-centered guided ideation and creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, anything that touches humans, service or product, right?
Right.
And that, I think that's the interesting when you look at the vast field of TPC, it touches everything.
Right. Yeah, definitely. You can be a technical communicator in healthcare, you can be a technical communicator in IT. Mm-hmm. Technical communicator in service industry, right? Which is why we are so we can embrace students from all different majors and different interests because we train them to we don't train them to be a technical writer, right? We train them to think in as communicators to think in this sort of design perspectives and to solve problems with certain kind of framework, you know, in this case, it would be design thinking. But also they do certainly pick up like writing skills and communication skills as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of important mechanics that go into the field as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's not just the writing. I think that sometimes the misconception is if you take a technical communication class, you're going to be a better writer, period. That's not it. That's not it. So, we're more than that. And we make you better people.
Absolutely. Right. It's not always easy for everyone to put themselves in the user's shoes or in someone else's shoes. It's not always, not all of us are skilled that way naturally or grow up learning how to do that well. But you've got a lot of exercises and things that you do in your teaching to help people get those skills, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So some examples are in the book. And I like the, so another aspect of design thinking is the whole notion of a bias toward action. So we encourage people to not just think about problems, but to address them through their actions. So they have to do something. They have to build something tangible. Doesn't always mean material. It could be digital to solve problems, right? So the exercises that I usually think about in the classroom are stemmed from that perspective that I want them to build something and then to address problems in a tangible form. Mm. Yeah, so I think that's the pedagogical benefits of design thinking.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like the makers market, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's the maker movement. And there's such a nice match between design thinking and making, because the maker movement too draws from design thinking as the problem solving framework. You know, they could have, you know, drawn from other kind of methods for solving problems, but they decided that design thinking is a good framework to teach, especially young makers. Like you say, we're not always taught that way growing up, how to address problems from a human or humane perspective. Yeah. So teaching young makers or early career makers how to address problems in that from that perspective is beneficial. So I'm thankful that the maker movement too are in agreement with design thinking.
And it shifts that innovation, right?
In terms of democratizing innovation, right? So given access to tools and spaces and a community of support that that encourages the innovation, it's important, and the maker movement does that, and the maker sort of culture in a classroom to aims to accomplish that is to build that sort of collective problem solving mindset. So so it democratizes it. So you don't have to be an expert to solve problems. You can be what they call a tinkerer, right? You experiment with solutions with a low stakes sort of approach, so you don't have to worry about high cost production of your solution, right? Because of, you know, thankfully with the DIY technologies that we have, like 3D printing, schools that can afford those, or community spaces, modeling software and applications and design, right? So now you can basically work from your own machine and your computer, and you can design something that can address some important problems. So I think that's a good sort of pedagogical approach in any majors, any discipline, I think, really, not just in technical and professional communication.
I wonder how we could adopt that in the professional sector, right? Sure.
Yeah,
I like how you're talking about, you know, when you're taking things from a design thinking perspective and from a maker's tinkerer perspective, it's not as, you don't have to be the expert, you don't have to be the know-it-all, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't have to be right before you even do anything.
Yes.
Right. The whole thing is to have an experiment and see what happens.
Yeah.
Right. And then document that experiment. So perhaps in the commercial sector, for those who are practitioners, if they could take a piece of that and just say, well, if I could take a part of the content that we create, or, you know, a section in the help center, or a particular product that's, you know, lower visibility, not as high risk. If I just take that one product that's kind of quiet in the corner, and I do design thinking with the content that's on that one little product out there, then we can do an experiment and see how it goes, right?
Right, yeah. So I'm glad you bring this up, because I think Google, I think it's the one that is attributed for this kind of program, where they have this 20% time where the employee can dedicate their work hours, 20% of the work hours that they're paid for, to innovate for either a personal project or something that benefits the community. And I think from a business and corporate standpoint, that is sort of like the paying forward, right, to the community by encouraging employees to spend the time using their skill sets and using facilities and resources from the company to solve problems that benefit people outside of the company. So it's not just for profit or for their own business gain. So I guess that's one model that we could go off of in industry where people.
Well, yeah, and that's nice when you've got a corporate model that supports it. we don't all live in that.
That's right. Yeah.
Everybody doesn't work for Google. So for other companies, you know, if you've got, you know, that low, it's lower visibility and you want to innovate a little, that might be a safe way to experiment and then prove it up, right? So that that then you can take it once you have some success. So you can say, this is successful. Then mm-hmm. you can innovate more, because sometimes it's hard, you know, when you're trapped in a culture and a corporate way of doing things, it's hard to say, okay, I want to take a risk.
Definitely. So another suggestion I have is collaboration with the community, right? Might not cost a lot, maybe time, but if smaller or individual businesses would encourage that sort of partnership with their local communities, they can then see, right, what kind of problems are impacting their own society, right? And be able to encourage professionals to use their skills and resources to address those. And I think that is another aspect of the maker movement that I really like. It is that going back to the whole social innovation, mm-hmm. right? Innovation that benefits the society rather than organizations.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing, right? There's a fair amount of public service, open source, public service projects. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them struggle for contributions, but at the same time, a lot of people participate. That seems like an ideal place for technical TPC communicator and professionals mm-hmm. to demonstrate skills and serve a self-fulfilling work, mm-hmm. like really beneficial stuff.
Yeah, and you bring up a really good point, because for those of you who are in companies who don't have, like, you're feeling like it's a little too stodgy and you're not going to be able to implement these radical new ideas, a lot of these companies have community outreach. Like, every company wants to outreach to the community. So under that, you may be able to get participation in mm-hmm. some community project. Right. That you can apply that, and it's a win-win for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because right. you'll get to implement the design thinking mm-hmm. In a very non-threatening, it doesn't touch, you know, the status quo, mm-hmm. but you'll be able to demonstrate some of the ways that, you know, you might be able to change your company's viewpoint on some radical ways mm-hmm. that you can change how you communicate, what you communicate as a corporation mm-hmm. through community outreach, like Liz says.
Right. Yeah. And those outreach more often than not benefits the company too, right? With the exposure, mm-hmm. right? Public relations.
Oh, yeah.
I think those are image building work.
Yes. And every corporation, no matter who they are, mm-hmm. likes to have community outreach, because mm-hmm. it does elevate them.
Right. Yeah. I think it's good to know your own community, because every community is slightly different, right? Where we live and the social conditions, like economic conditions that we're in. So it's important for companies to not be too removed from those issues, right? Knowing what the local people really struggle with and how your product and services could help serve some of those in nonprofit ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So you bring up a phrase, and I want you to kind of expand on it. You talk about radical collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So can you share with us what is radical collaboration?
Yes. So radical collaboration is an attribute of design thinking. So it's so if you go back to the whole mindset, right? It's to when you want to design human-centered solutions. What design thinking advocates for is that the best way to do that is in radical collaboration. So radical here means you decentralize power and hierarchy. So there's not a traditional pyramid style structure that mm-hmm. controls the design process. It's more flattened. So anyone could participate in the process. You don't need, again, you don't need the experience. You don't need the expertise. We want your voices in the design process. The more, the better. The more diverse, the better it is. And we all actively contribute to this problem-solving process. So that's what, in brief, that's what the radical collaboration attribute means. In how I have applied it, or and the examples that I provided in the book near the end, is through my own experience as a graduate student when I was at Minnesota, that I was invited to all these kind of big projects that I didn't feel I have the expertise or background to contribute to. But the practitioners in those projects embrace radical collaboration. They were willing to bring me in and guide me and let me contribute with what I have, right? And that takes all of our work into different directions, and it benefited us and the projects. So I think that really motivated me to kind of dig in even deeper and, you know, wanting to create a heuristic and a framework around that so other teachers or researchers could also consider radical collaboration in their classroom, in their own work, in their projects, you know, or even, you know, for the professionals who are at, in industry as well.
So what was that like, right? Because that's not an uncommon thing to hear from TPC professionals, right? I'm not the expert. How, you know, I don't belong. Like that's typically, we like to have all our ducks in a row and understand before we go in. Mm-hmm. What was that like? How did you bridge that?
Well, I think just telling people that they do not have to start with solutions, right? You do not have to start with what you already know. The goal is to explore and to invite participation. I think that itself is a good motivator for folks to just get started and work with people that they don't commonly work with. I think that's an important part, that our workplace is becoming more cross-functional and diverse and global, especially this virtual sort of scenario that is taking us to a different level of co-working, right? And I think it is important to practice being with folks who are from a different background and have very different worldview than you, and being able to solve problems together. I think that's going to make us a better humanity in general, right? But for the purpose of like problem solving for businesses and organizations, I think that by encouraging the radical collaboration, sometimes you will arrive at breakthroughs, right? If you put a medical professional, an engineer, an artist in the same room, they're going to come up with very different things, right? A same problem. But if they work together, right, that solution is going to be something that we have not seen before.
Well, and it's back to those lenses that you were talking about earlier in the perspective, because how we view the world is influenced by those disciplines, and artists will view things very differently, right? And the questions that TPC people ask, engineers aren't typically asking those questions. They don't even think to ask those questions. Like, you know, they make some assumptions, right?
Or they're trained to answer they're trained to ask different questions.
Yes. I like how Liz puts it, right? They're trained in the different lens that they see the world through. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, a lot of times we benefit from them too, right? We benefit from the sort of mathematical and coding, sort of code-driven thinking. It's something that we need to, that sort of logical thinking guided by, you know, the sort of expressions that we haven't done a good job in training our students. So we benefit from those, from engineers.
Well, yeah. And it's, back to the word collaboration. That's why collaboration is always stronger, right? And when you're collaborating, even if you're just collaborating inside a writing team.
Yes.
Just collaborations are stronger because writer to writer, you don't see things the same way either, right? There are certain things you're trained on the same, but you have different lenses because your human experience influences.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And your professional experience as well, right? So radical collaboration says that, you know, regardless of your expertise and number of years in doing something, we're all put on the same level. So when you collaborate, we don't discount someone's you know, their the background or what they know or do not know, right? So I learned best really from collaborating with students. Some faculties do, some don't. I co-author papers with my students, and I learned so much from how they see the world. And it's sort of different from sometimes, because sometimes how I address problems, like I have a very structured way of writing a paper, a research paper, a scientific paper for a journal. And they come in, sort of overturn the whole thing for me. And I learn from them in that process, right? And they learn from me. So I do not discount that maybe they have not published before, or they have not written something in this genre. Doesn't mean that they have nothing to say, right?
Right.
So that's what the radical collaboration mindset advocates for, is to put down our own pride and our own what we think is our expertise at the level with others, and work together. I think that's the attribute itself.
I'm that way too, actually. I get it's part of why I like to bring people together in things like this, because you never know where that, what is going to spark that idea, or what is going to change everything and make something work.
Right.
Or change your perspective and like have that realization. Mm-hmm. Right. You got to talk to people in different disciplines from different places in their career, different industries, different perspectives, different cultures. It's the only way, because you only ever have your own experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or we think in similar terms, if you only work with people that you already are comfortable working with, right? So the communication scholars call it group thing, right? It's you have a group and you have a group mentality and you stay with that. So we have to always kind of move people in and out of teams to switch out that sort of mentality, diversify.
Yeah, well, it's interesting too, because, you know, in the professional world, we run into this more than one time. Why do you do this?
Right.
That's, we've always done it that way. Why do your warnings look like this? Do you have to, you know, is the style of your output, you know, is this required or not? Well, I don't know. We've always done it that way. You know, you could do it differently.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to present information that way. They're like, oh, right. So, you know, we can kind of get stuck in the, we've always done it that way.
Yes. You become very accepting of, you know, a way of being very quickly. I think as human beings, that's sort of our nature. We stick to what's comfortable and we stick to what works. Right. I do not like the phrase that says, if it is not broken, don't
try fix it.
Yeah. that means no innovation, right?
Right.
Nothing new.
I think there's a healthy balance between innovation and tried and true. Sometimes, you know, you got to pick your battles too.
And that's why you collaborate, right? There are going to be movers and shakers who come into your team and disrupt processes, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of times those are positive disruption, because it brings you to a different mentality, a different way of seeing things that, you know, that you may not have before.
And it's interesting that you bring that up, because, you know, that rule, I think, applies to everything. It applies to hiring for your writing teams. It applies to, you know, scholarly endeavors. It applies to charity, you know, charitable organizations or professional organizations. Don't look to just bring, you know, people in that are just like you. Look to bring disruptors in.
Yes.
People who think a little different, look a little different, act a little different. Right, have different circles, because it's going to make things richer. Right,
so much energy there.
Yeah, that's so important.
And it's not always easy. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's not. It's not.
It's not easy. Let's be clear. It's not easy. Management becomes more challenging. Right, deliverables. You know, they take on a different life. Right, so you know, management becomes a little more challenging in that situation, but the end product becomes stronger and richer when you have that diversity, right? You know, the end the end organization, the end events become richer when you have that diversity.
Definitely. Yeah, because your users and consumers are diverse too. So mm-hmm. that definitely benefits the product if you have a diverse team building it. They represent the users in some ways.
Right, right. So I think that
it's really interesting that,
go ahead,
that you are the one who has come this way, and because you know you had that experience where they invited you over and over.
Right.
Right. Yeah. We can see how beneficial that is. It's really neat.
Right. And all it takes is that invitation, right? It's opening the door and letting people come in if they want to extend the invitation no matter what. I think that's something that we all can do better, right? We all need to be more welcoming and not just here, this is my project and this is my thing. And it takes a little bit of like being vulnerable in order to do that, right? To open up and to not, to the word that we use in the book is to suspend judgment, right? To not evaluate too quickly. Just let it be and, you know, work through with this new person or this, you know, person with different background expertise and see where it goes, right?
Yeah. And if, you know, well, and here's the thing, you know, because as human beings, our human tendency is to judge, and that's just the survival of the species. Mm-hmm. That's our psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most important thing is to be cognizant of your judgments and be aware of your biases.
Yeah.
So that you can police yourself and not inflict them on others, right? Because you're going to have them. You're not going to escape them. Nobody is going to be completely neutral all the time. But being aware of your biases and being aware of those judgments and how they influence your actions allows you, I think, to police them so that you're not, right?
Right, yeah. So the framework that I was building with the radical collaboration builds this in as a checkpoint. Right. That it's not my own, not just my own awareness, but others have to remind me when I come across as, oh, you're evaluating, you're judging too quickly now, right? And it has to be a guiding principle for that team to work. So each other, we would tell each other, right, to suspend our judgment and to extend invitation. So we'll ask ourselves constantly, are we inviting, right? Are we opening our doors to others, right? Or are we becoming stagnant in as a team? You know, it's just us.
Yeah.
And are we judging?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. And our time is up.
Is it?
It's hard to believe. Yeah. Oh,
that went by really.
I have more to talk about.
Quickly.
Wow, that time flew by fast. I'm so glad that you were able to join
me. Me too.
It has been just a delight to talk with you.
Yes, and likewise.
Yeah, and I hope to have you back again someday.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yes. And everybody, get the book. It's really, it's a good book.
There.
It is. There it is.
Mine is on Kindle, so I can't really like
show Kindle
you.
Too.
I know, I thought about, if I could print the cover out and have it on a piece of paper.
there are links in the on the page, right?
There are links absolutely. For people to go and get the book.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I have it on Kindle.
Thank you.
I can't show you a print copy. All right, well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Been a delight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and same for me too. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be talking soon, Jason.
Okay.
Yeah. We have plans for you. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Yeah.